Ladies and gentlemen, I'm now going to read to you a little story which has no real connection with the Kabbalah. However, as far as I can see, everything has a connection with the Kabbalah. So even this story has a connection. It is called The Missing Light. I would just prepare a little water, which is always good for a speaker. I just don't know. Maybe the light should be better like this. Toward evening, the large hall of the Yiddish Writers Club in Warsaw became almost empty. At a table in a corner, two unemployed proofreaders played chess. They seemed to play and doze simultaneously. Mina the cat had forgotten that she is a literary cat, written up in the newspapers, and went out to the yard to hunt for a mouse or perhaps a bird. I was sitting at a table with the most important member of the Yiddish Writers Club, Joshua Gottlieb, the main columnist of the newspaper Hind. He was the president of the journalistic syndicate, a doctor of philosophy, a former student of such famous scholars as Hermann Cohen, Professor Bauch, Professor Messer, Kuna Fischer. Dr. Gottlieb was tall, broad-shouldered, with a straight red neck and a pot belly. The setting sun threw a purple shine on his huge, bald head. He smoked a long cigar and blew the smoke out through his nostrils. He would not have invited a beginner like myself at this table, but there was no one else available at this hour, and he liked to talk and tell stories. Our conversation turned to the supernatural, and Dr. Gottlieb was saying, "You young men are in a rush to explain everything according to your theories. For you, it is theory first and the facts last. If the facts don't match the theories, it is the fault of the facts. But a man in my age knows that the events have a logic of their own, and that above all, they are the product of causality. You are mystics, feel insulted if things happen in what we call a natural way. But to me, the greatest and most wonderful miracle is what Spinoza called the order of things. When I lose my glasses and find them in a drawer, of which I was sure I haven't opened in 2 years, I know that I had put them there myself only 5 minutes ago. I did it, but not the demons or the imps. The eyeglasses would have stayed there forever, no matter how many incantations I would have recited to retrieve them." As you know, I'm a great admirer of Kant, of the philosopher Kant. But to me, causality is more than a category of pure reason. It is the very essence of creation. You may even call it the thing in itself. Dr. Gottlieb, who made causality, I asked, just to say something. No one made it, and therein is its beauty. Let me tell you, about 2 years ago, something happened to me which had all the earmarks of one of your miracles. I was absolutely convinced that no explanation was possible. Rationalist as I am, I said to myself, if this actually happened, and it was not a dream, I will have to reappraise everything I learned from first-class gymnasium to the universities of Bonn and Bern. But then came the explanation, and it was as convincing and as simple as only the truth can be. As a matter of fact, I thought I would write this story myself. However, I don't want to compete with our literati. I guess you know that I don't have too high an opinion of fiction. If it may sound sacrilege to you, but I find more human fallacies, more psychology, and even more entertainment in the daily press than in all your literary magazines, which no one can understand. Does my cigar bother you? Not at all. You certainly know, I don't need to tell you, that our typesetters in the Hind and in the Yiddish press generally make more errors than all the other typesetters in the whole world. Although they consider themselves ardent Yiddishists, they don't have the slightest respect for their language. I don't sleep nights because of these barbarians. Who said it, that writers don't die from cancer, but from misprints? Every week, I read three proofs of my Friday column. But when they correct one mistake, they immediately make another mistake, and sometimes two, three, four. About 2 years ago, I happened to write an article about the same Immanuel Kant. It was a jubileum of some sort. When it comes to philosophic terms, our typesetters are especially vicious. Besides, the one who does the layout has a tradition of losing at least one line from my column every week. And I always find it in another article. Sometimes even in the news. That day, I quoted an expression of Kant, which was a perfect target for misprints, the transcendental unity of the apperception. While I wrote it, I knew that our typesetters would make mincemeat out of it. But I could not avoid it. I read the proofs three times, as usual, and miraculously the words came out correct the third time. I even uttered a little prayer just in case. That Thursday night, I went to sleep as hopeful as a writer in Yiddish can afford to be. The Yiddish papers are brought to me about 8 o'clock in the morning, and Friday is always the crisis of the week for me. In the beginning, everything seemed quite smooth, and I hoped against hope that this time I would be saved. But no, the line which began with the verse, the transcendental unity of the perception, has been lost. The whole article became senseless. Of course, I was angry, bitter. I cursed all the Yiddish typesetters with the vilest thoughts. After some half an hour of utter resentment and extreme anti-Yiddishism, I began to look for the line in all the other articles. of our Friday issue, but this time it seemed to have been lost altogether. Even this was somehow a disappointment to me. What burns me up more than anything else is the fact that people in the street, even my friends in the writers' club, compliment me, praise me, and they never seem to miss the missing line. I have promised myself a million times not to read The Hind on Friday, but you know there is an element of masochism in each of us. In my imagination, I took revenge on the typesetters, the editors, the proofreaders, shooting them, hanging them, or making them memorize all of my columns from the year 1910 until today. After a while, I decided that I have suffered enough, and I began to read The Moment, our competition newspaper. Especially to see what their columnist, Dr. Helfman, had written for that Friday. Of course, I knew beforehand that his piece could not be anything but bad. In all the 20 years we compete, I have never read anything good by this scribbler. I don't know how you feel about him, but to me, he is sheer abomination. That Friday, his concoction seemed worse than ever, as it does every week. So I gave up in the middle and began to read the news. I was reading a news item with the title, A Man, a Beast. The story of a janitor who came home at night from the tavern and raped his daughter. Suddenly I saw the most impossible, the most unbelievable, the most preposterous thing that could ever happen. My missing line was right there. I knew that it could be nothing but a hallucination. However, hallucinations seldom last longer than a second or a split second. Here the words lingered before my eyes, the transcendental unity of the apperception. I closed my eyes, sure that when I opened them again, the mirage would have vanished. But I opened them, and there it still was, the unthinkable, the ridiculous, the absurd. I must admit to you that while disbelieving in what you call the supernatural, I somehow toyed with the idea that one day a phenomenon might emerge in my life which would force me to lose faith in logic and reality, but that a metal line would fly from the Hind composing room on Chlodner Street number 8 to the Moment composing room on Alefki 38, this I certainly did not expect. My son came into the room, and I must have looked as if I had seen a ghost, because he said to me, "Papa, what's the matter?" I don't know why, but I said to him, "Please go down and buy me a copy of The Moment." "But you are reading The Moment right now," my boy said. And I answered that I must see another copy. The boy looked at me as if to say, "The old man is meshuggah altogether." Still, he went down and bought me another copy. Sure enough, my line was there on the same page in the same news item. He came home from the tavern late at night, saw his daughter in her bed, and the transcendental unity of the apperception. I was so baffled and distressed that I began to laugh. To be completely on the safe side, I asked my boy to read the whole item out loud. He again gave me that look which meant my father is not all there, and he read the item to me. When he came to the transposed line, he smiled and asked, "Is this why you asked me to buy you another copy?" I didn't answer him, but I knew that no hallucination has ever been shared by two people. And certainly not for such a long time, unless my boy too became a part of my hallucination. Dr. Gottlieb, I said, there are cases of collective hallucinations. Anyhow, that Friday and Saturday, I couldn't sleep and I could barely eat. I decided to go Sunday morning and speak to my friend, the manager of the printing department, Dr. Gavze. If there is a man who cannot be fooled by abracadabra and hocus pocus, it is he. I wanted to see the expression on his face when he sees what I saw. On the way to the Hind, I decided it would have been a good thing if I could find the manuscript of the column, if they haven't thrown it out. I asked if the copy of my article is still there, and lo and behold, they found it. And the words were there as I remembered it. I was eager to find a solution to my riddle, but I didn't want the solution to be based on some silly blunder, ludicrous misunderstanding, or lapse of memory. With my manuscript in one hand and the Friday moment in the other hand, I went to Mr. Gavze, and he too gave me a strange look, because I never go there on Sunday. I showed him my manuscript and said, "Please read this paragraph." Before I finished my sentence, he said, "I know, I know. A line was missing in your column about Kant. I guess you want to publish a correction. Believe me, no one ever reads that." "No, I don't want to publish any corrections," I said. "What else brings you here on Sunday morning?" Gavze asked. I showed him the Friday moment with the item A Man, A Beast, and said, "Now read this." Gavze shrugged, began to read, and never before have I seen an expression like this on Gavze's quiet face. He gaped at the news item, at my manuscript, at me, again at the paper, again at me, and said, "Am I seeing things? This is your missing line." "Yes, my friend," I said, "my missing line has jumped from the Hind to the moment, a dozen streets away, over all the buildings, all the rooftops, and settled down right into their printing room, right into this item. Or possibly the demons did the job. If you can explain this, then..." "Really, I cannot believe it," Gavze said. "This must be some trick, some kind of practical joke. Maybe someone glued in the line. Let me see it again." "No trick and no glue," I said. "This line fell out from my article and it appeared in the Moment last Friday. I have another copy of the Moment with me." "My God, how did this happen?" Gavze asked. Again and again, he compared my manuscript with the line in the Moment. Then I heard him say, "If this can happen, anything can happen. Maybe the demons really did steal your line from the Hind and carried it to the Moment." "This is the only possible explanation," I said. For a long while, we both stood there and looking at each other with the painful feeling of two adult men who realize that the world has turned to chaos, all logic gone, and what is called reality is totally bankrupt. Then Gavze burst out laughing. "No, it wasn't the demons, not even the angels. I know what happened." "If you know, say it quickly before I burst," I said. "And here is the explanation And the way he explained it to me, the Jewish National Fund often publishes an appeal, both in the Hind and the Moment. Sometimes they make changes to adjust the appeal for the readers of the respective newspapers. Then they don't make a matrix, but the whole metal page is carried over by car from one newspaper to the other for adjustment. By error, my line must have been put into the metal page of the United Jewish Appeal. It was carried over to the Moment, and they, as someone noticed the mistake, took out the line from the appeal page and put it promptly into this news item, A Man, A Beast. The chances that such a thing should happen are not as small as one may think, Gavze said, if you know our proofreaders and our typesetters. They are the voice bunglers. No, let's not put the fault on the poor demons. No demon is as ignorant and as careless as our printers and the printers' devils. We had a great laugh, and in honor of that historical solution, we went and had coffee and cake. We spoke about the old times and the countless absurdities published in the Yiddish press, God bless it. Like the King Siam and his 7 crown princes. This, of course, is nonsense because there's only 1 crown prince. There cannot be 7. Or that the sun has millions of grades of temperature inside, and there the heat is unbearable. Dr. Gottlieb paused, trying to revive the extinguished cigar, sucking at it violently. Then he said, my young man, I tell you all this just to prove to you that one should not be in a rush to decide that modern nature has given up its eternal laws and that the goblins and hobgoblins and sprites have taken over. As far as I am concerned, the laws of nature are still valid whether I like them or not. And when I have to convey a message to my old wife or to my not much younger girlfriend, I still use the telephone, not telepathy. Thank you very much.
Mr. Singer offered to entertain questions. Yes?
Maybe I'm trying to answer the question, sitting on. I got a little tired. Let's hear the questions. Can I?
And could you make it loud so we can hear?
No. Fine. I will stand there. Come over, Dr. Gilman. You translate me these things into English. What did the young man say?
Purpose of creation or the purpose of man's
Well, the Kabbalah did not believe that man is God, but the Kabbalah believed that we are all made of the same substance of God himself. In other words, God is made of internal light, of a light of which never ends in quality and in quantity, and we are just a little light, a dim little light, but still we are made of the same stuff as he. In other words, I wouldn't say that man is God, according to the Kabbalah, but man is a part of God. Yes, please.
Yes. You said you were an admirer of David Hume, and I am too. But he said at one point about prayer that if God is omnipotent, omniscient, and benevolent, the only good can come from him, so why pray to him? If he is not omnipotent, omniscient, and benevolent, then why pray to him?
The gentleman says that he also likes very much David Hume, but he says that David Hume asked a question about God. He said, if he is good, he will do you good anyhow, why do you have to pray to him? And if he is bad, what can the prayer help? It's a very good question. If God would be here, maybe he would answer it. Let me tell you, ladies and gentlemen, that prayer sometimes even helps in this world. I know of cases where a man met another man, a man with great power, and he said, you have to go to prison for 10 years. And then the man got up and said, my dear judge, I'm an orphan, I'm unhappy, I did a foolish thing, it's the first time, do me a favor, send me only for 1 year in prison. So the judge said, no, I have no mercy. And then for a while said, you are still a young man. Okay, let it be 1 year. And before the man left, the judge said, I will make it 2 years on probation. So you see that prayer even helps in this world. And since we are all parts of God, maybe the Almighty also changes his mind once in a while. Anyhow, what do we lose by trying?
I only help my friends help animals. You said that that the Noah, animals are sacred, and I understand. I was happy to hear that you don't eat meat. Could you explain why?
If you pray in Hebrew, you will see that it's mentioned even in the prayer Chayas HaKodesh, holy animals. They believe that since we are created in God's image, and you know that we have eyes and nose and mouth, and so have animals. So because of this, if we resemble God, they also resemble to a higher extent God, maybe less than we. So I will tell you, these things are really not to be discussed, because it's not something for science or rationalism. Either you believe in them or you don't believe in them. Even if you don't believe in them, they are beautiful anyhow. They are full of poetry. So you can take it in any way you feel like it. In other words, I cannot really tell you what these sacred animals are. I haven't been in the higher spheres for some time. So we have just to make peace that many people believed in them. And we know that many things which we considered folklore later turned out to be science, or at least a part of science. So maybe there is some truth in this too. Anyhow, I'm a vegetarian. If man is born in the image of God, I'm sure that so are animals. This is the reason I don't want to eat them. I don't like to eat part of the Almighty. What made you scream? Thank you very much. Yes, please.
Thank you.
The gentleman.
Am I right in understanding from your writings that you have never loved any place more than you love Warsaw?
Well, I will tell you, when it comes, love is not something of quantity where you can really say, I love one thing more than the other. Of course, as I lived in Warsaw, for many years, and I loved the city, especially when I heard that the city was destroyed. I began to love it more, as we love our someone near to us. If we hear that this person is not here anymore, and we cannot do him any favors, neither good nor evil. But I now, since I've lived in New York even longer than in Warsaw, I developed a love for New York too. But since New York still exists, and I every day see the headlines in the New York Post, I cannot love it, because every time I read it, I say, I wish I could run away from this miserable city. I would say that while I love Warsaw completely, I have with New York a love-hatred kind of relation.
Stand up.
You see the favor of David Hume, like he said at the beginning of the lecture, I'm just curious about your own reasons for your mystical side, which I know you have, which I've read you have, and then you just said you have. Because isn't the Kabbalah just a book also, written by people? Is it, you just believe in a mystical realm?
Of course, when I quote the Kabbalist, I don't say that everything they say is 100% true, that God revealed himself to them. I tell you a way of thinking of these men, and I say that there is great beauty and even consistency in their theory or in their religion or in their mysticism. Call it as you want. I'm not here really to tell you what is true and what is false. When it comes to these higher questions, we never know the truth. We can never say things for sure. Even David Hume said, even though the sun has been rising for millions of years every day, we still don't have proof that this will happen the next day. So when the sun comes up tomorrow and you look at it, it's in a way something new. So this is more in this way I speak about the Kabbalah and about all these things from the point of view of a skeptic who still cannot believe that the world was created without any plan. I just want to add a few words. Let's say if you go somewhere to an island in the Pacific, to the Fiji Island or somewhere, and you go there to an island about which people are convinced that no one has ever been there. You go there with another man, and suddenly you find a wristwatch there. When you find a wristwatch, you say, oh, there was a man there. And let's imagine that this man saw no one has ever been there. And you say, what is this wristwatch doing here? He said there was metal there, and there was glass, and in a billion years, the metal and the glass approached one another, and there was an evolution, and this evolution brought out this wristwatch. You would say no evolution and no billions of years could do it. And I feel the same thing about the universe. I say, is the universe less complicated than a wristwatch?
One more question.
Here's the gentleman or the lady, I don't know myself. Nowadays, it's yes. The lady wants to know what is the future of the Yiddish language. I will tell you, I hear this question very often, especially from my cronies, my friends in the Jewish Daily Forward. And we sit there to have lunch in this cafeteria. I hear every day the same question, what will happen to Yiddish? The language is dying, every day we lose readers. So I say to them, I have some comfort for you. So they say, comfort? What kind of comfort? I say, we are having now about 4 billion people. But 100 years from now, we may have 100 billion people, the way we multiply. And every one of those 100 billion people will need a topic for a PhD. You can imagine, I tell them how many dissertations they are going to write about Yiddish. So we are not going to be completely forgotten.